eighth case, Areola v. Holder. Mr. Kahn.
May it please the Court, my name is Ira Kahn, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Jorge Torres Areola, who is president of the Court. We're asking this Court to reverse the BIA's decision, which denied petitioner's request to remand his case to the immigration judge for further proceedings and its denial of his appeal. Among the issues before this Court is whether the BIA committed an error of law when it mischaracterized the evidence before it during its consideration of petitioner's appeal, and whether further it abused its discretion. But before I deal with that issue, I first want to deal with the issue of the status of the respondent, of the petitioner as a criminal alien from a jurisdictional standpoint. The petitioner in this case is an arriving alien who was returning from a trip abroad. He went to Mexico. He was a permanent resident. That would make him subject to exclusion rather than removal from the United States and a totally different regulatory provision applies to him as far as contrary to what was cited by the government. Mr. Torres is, in fact, eligible for an I-601 waiver of inadmissibility. And in a situation involving a direct removal, he would be severely limited under those proceedings. Further, the only crime which appears to be relevant in this case was the fact that Mr. Torres had committed an offense of simple possession of marijuana less than 2.5 grams. But what's even more important in this case is, and why we believe there's jurisdiction in this case, is pursuant to 8 U.S.C. 1252A, this federal court has authority to review final agency decisions. We believe that appellate review is proper in this case, and in that statute it says, where an agency tribunal abuses its discretionary authority, where there are unresolved questions of law, or where a petitioner raises a constitutional claim. In this case, we believe the BIA acted beyond its scope of review, provided in 8 CFR 103.1D3, in that in the record of appeal, the BIA in its decision specifically said that the petitioner did not maintain contact with his attorney. In fact, a close review of the record will reveal the contrary, that in fact, Mr. Torres did maintain contact with his attorney.
That's a question of fact, is it not?
But what the problem with this particular question of fact is when the BIA, in its record, Your Honor, makes its decision, it mischaracterizes the evidence in the record. And we believe that finding that mischaracterization raises it to the level of not just being a question of fact, rather it goes beyond that and becomes a question of law. And I believe that is why there is a basis for review. Throughout the record, there are instances in which Mr. Elish, counsel for the previous counsel for the respondent, was apprised by the courts of his responsibility. He had over a year, in the record it will reveal itself, to file a simple petition. And once he assumed the responsibilities of counsel and was apprised by the court, we believe that his actions in failing to file this waiver request, which resulted in a default against the petitioner, severely prejudiced his rights. In fact, later in the record, there is a point where where Drew Elish, the attorney, acknowledges that he did stay in touch with his client. Also, a review of the record will indicate that initially the respondent petitioner paid $800 in an initial retainer, And for an entire – and represented to the court on that hearing, I believe it was a June 2006 hearing, that a 601 waiver would be immediately filed. The judge asked the petitioner that to have it filed at least 6 months prior to the next hearing. That matter, this petition was this waiver petition was not filed until about 10 days before the actual merits hearing in the case. I believe that Mr. Torres had a right to rely on his counsel, particularly when he gave him at least $800, arguably close to $3,000, to file a simple form in a timely fashion. Further, we believe that the BIA has made an obvious mistake in misreading the evidence. This is evident, and it's what we believe in its poorly reasoned opinion in denying the petitioner's request for relief. Finally, the board's decision prejudiced Mr. Torres in that had they not misread the record, they would likely have ruled in Mr. Torres's favor. We state that because the balance of the evidence is in petitioner's favor. Petitioner has been stating all along that he has been adequately represented. Although this is not in front of the court, and I will supplement the record, the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission has recommended suspension of his previous counsel, Mr. Ellish, for 90 days because of negligence in the handling of two matters, which involve, and I reference that in my brief. However, that I just discovered that this decision came down yesterday for a similar type of conduct, failing to file forms, failing to maintain contact with his client, and failing to do things he was obligated to do. In conclusion, we contend that the BIA made errors of law such that this court should reverse the BIA's denial of Mr. Torres's request for remand and remand this case to the IJ for further proceedings and an opportunity to adequately present his case.
Thank you, Mr. Kahn. Ms. Wellhoff?
Good morning, Your Honors. Ann Wellhoff for Respondent, United States Attorney General Holder. May it please the Court. Your Honor, the Court lacks jurisdiction to hear this case for two independent reasons. The first and perhaps the most the simple reason is that this petitioner was found removable on account of having committed and been convicted of a controlled substance violation. The criminal alien bar at 8 U.S.C. 1252 A2C applies in this case. That his petitioner's alienage is undisputed. It is undisputed that he was removed on account of his controlled substance offense, and I would point out that the petitioner admitted and conceded removability on this record. I would refer the court to the administrative record at pages 93 and 95, where the immigration judge went through each of the factual allegations as well as the charge of removability with the alien. He was represented by counsel at that proceeding, and the factual allegations were admitted, and removability was conceded. I'd also direct the court to the administrative record at page 123, where the immigration judge confirms, in case there is any confusion here, I am finding you removable on account of your criminal conviction. So the criminal alien jurisdictional bar applies in this case. As this court's aware, if the petitioner raises a colorable legal or constitutional claim, the court to that extent is entitled to or has jurisdiction to hear the case. Notwithstanding the particular label that petitioner's counsel wants to place on his disagreements, his disagreement is in fact with the factual findings of the board, factual findings that the board made en route to exercising its discretion, in this case, denying a motion to remand. That is not the arguments that are put forth are quintessential factual arguments. He seeks this court to reweigh and rebalance the evidence and find, in fact, on the balance of the evidence, that petitioner's attorney was ineffective. That is a quintessential factual question, and this court should not delve into that for two reasons. One, because the criminal alien bar applies. Additionally, the court's controlling precedential case of Kukana applies in this case. What we're looking at here is the agency exercising its discretion and denying a motion to remand. Again, unless there's a constitutional or legal question presented to the court, this court has found that it lacks jurisdiction to review that discretionary agency action. And the statutory provision which strips the court of jurisdiction over the discretionary matters is found at 8 U.S.C. 1252 A2B ii. So Kukana controls this case, but I would submit that the court need not even reach the second jurisdictional bar in this case, because the first bar for criminal alien is, it's undisputed that it applies in this case.
Has the government accepted the Kukana?
Your Honor, as the government announced during the argument of Kukana case, our position differed from that of the court, but we recognize that Kukana is the precedent in this court.
I understand that. I'm just asking.
Well, the government took a contrary position, Your Honor. Okay. But we, again, that's the law in the circuit, and we accept that, and we believe that the court's precedent in this case applies squarely to the facts here, and that the really only remedy that petitioner is seeking here is a reweighing of the evidence, the factual evidence en route, exercising its discretion. And that is insulated from jurisdiction as well. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to entertain those, but respondent has no further comments.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Willow.
Thank you.
Mr. Kahn.
In rebuttal, Your Honor, with respect to Kukana, I'm reasonably certain in the holding in Kukana that there was language that if there is a material issue of fact that goes to the heart of the matter, that can raise a question of fact beyond a simple question of fact and become a question of law. It is the position of the petitioner that when the BIA concluded and completely ignored affidavits and other substantive evidence which was part of the record, and concluded that the respondent does not dispute the fact that he failed to keep in touch with his attorney, or that he did not specifically pay for the filing for the Form I-601, that is a factual finding that's an error. A proper review of the record and review of the evidence would have indicated that not only was the petitioner's affidavit totally ignored, but substantive proofs that were part of the record were also ignored. So I believe that in and of itself raises this question of fact beyond just a question of fact, but a mischaracterization of fact. A question of fact is usually a dispute between parties and litigants. When there's a clear factual dispute between a reviewing authority and a petitioner, that is treated in a different, separate type of classification. Further, on the issue with respect to the criminal issue, as counsel for the government has indicated, if there is an independent basis in law for this court to exercise jurisdiction, which I believe there is, they can do that. Further, I believe that due to the nature of his status as a returning alien, the standard for review would be different in that case. I believe that if this matter is remanded to the trial court, that findings of fact can be made on these issues, and ultimately, I believe he's deserving of a opportunity to have his I-601 reviewed, and would respectfully request that this court grant relief in his favor. Just as a slight other matter, I'd like the court to be aware that he does have an 8-year-old son that is dependent on him for support. He also has close relatives who are permanent residents, and he really doesn't have anybody left in Mexico. I believe under the totality of the circumstances, I'm respectfully requesting that this court reverse and remand this matter to the immigration court for further proceedings.
He did go back and visit his grandparents. I guess that's the reason he left.
That was the reason.
Are they gone or they're no longer there?
His grandparents are elderly. They're in their 80s, and okay. It was just a family visit type thing.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Khan. Thank you, Mr. Wallace. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.